This is your lucky day. You have the once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to pay amazingly high prices for some incredibly worthless stuff. Just keep listening, and we'll tell you over and 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 over.
Aren't you glad this is KBOO? KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. Non-commercial.
Over and over and over and over and over.
There's something missing and I'm lit and I got something to say. Oh yeah. All of the witches and the demons better get out my way.
Welcome to Trans Positive. Today we're speaking with Thea Santos from the Center for American Progress. I'm Nicolette. I use AM or they, them pronouns.
My name's Emma. I use she and her pronouns.
And hi, I'm Thea. She, her pronouns, please.
All right, great. Jean, do you want to introduce yourself?
And I'm Jean Bryant, one of the regular co-hosts, she, her pronouns.
All right. So, Thea, why don't you introduce yourself and tell us about yourself?
Well, my name is Thea Santos. I am a Filipino-American transgender woman from New Haven, Connecticut. And I started working at Center for American Progress on LGBTQ-related policy last year. Our team does a variety of coordinating research and advocacy work on generally federal policy, so nationwide policy that affects LGBTQ communities. Recently in 2020, we conducted a nationally representative survey of LGBTQ adults in the US, and we've been steadily releasing breakdowns of data from that survey on various constituencies of different racial and ethnic groups, focusing on transgender respondents, and a lot of our work focuses on non-discrimination protections, so civil rights, however you want to phrase it, making sure that people can't be turned away by doctors, can't be, you know, thrown out of businesses, denied employment, that sort of thing. But we also do work in LGBTQ immigration spaces, ensuring basic safety in detention and getting people out of detention, criminal justice reform, housing security, poverty work. There's a lot of different folks around the country doing a lot of work for LGBTQ folks in policy, and we try to make sure that those voices get brought to the rooms where they can be heard.
Okay, thanks. So the topic of our show today is we're really trying to focus on the issue of trans kids and transgender athletes more generally. Mm-hmm. So my first question for you, Thea, is which states are currently considering legislation to interfere with trans kids participating in sports?
Well, this year in 2021 alone, 36 states, last time I checked, have introduced bans on trans kids participating in sports. The bans are generally targeted specifically to keep transgender girls out of gender segregated sports. And nine of these bills, in nine states, these bills have passed. Although in Idaho and West Virginia, both of those bills have been enjoined by federal judges. So they are not being implemented because of their unconstitutionality.
Thank you.
Yeah, so for people who might not be aware, could you tell us a little more about what exactly these bills entail and what those implications of, what the implications of those bills might be?
Yeah, I think there are lots of folks who've done a great job explaining this, and I'm just trying to follow up on them. I'd first of all suggest checking out Imara Jones's Translash podcast, where she really goes into the structures of where these bills are coming from. So basically, what they're focusing on is a specific type of anti-trans legislation that they initially tried in Idaho last year. And the idea is stoke anti-LGBTQ and anti-trans fervor very specifically by fear-mongering around the idea of transgender girls competing in women's sports and leveraging some sort of unfair competitive advantage due to hormones, random things about trans bodies, you know? And it's, I think the first thing to emphasize is that it's entirely a non-issue. There are maybe a couple examples that conservatives use to highlight instances where transgender girls and women have competed at any sort of elite level in women's sports. The reason they can only bring up usually one case in Connecticut is because it's just not a thing that happens very much. Sports teams aren't always very friendly places for trans people. And it wasn't like a focus of LGBTQ policy advocacy before this to try and like expand athletic participation specifically. We're always fighting for inclusive policies in schools and other things like that. But it wasn't like something we were talking about. It is something that was deliberately coordinated by a variety of Christian right organizations, naming Alliance Defending Freedom, Focus on the Family, Heritage Foundation, and a few others to really choose an issue about transgender people that they think they could message well. And create a national campaign around it. So they've been, Alliance Defending Freedom specifically, has been drafting legislation for state legislators to introduce in their own state houses. They'll get, oh, sorry, Jean. Got it. Yeah, so state legislators will go to the ADF website, get in contact with these Christian fundamentalists. They're all lawyers. They'll draft them Christian fundamentalist legislation. They'll bring it to the floor. Most of these legislators cannot name a transgender person that they know in person. They have no examples of transgender people in their state competing in athletics. And they will introduce these bills, and there'll be a lot of loud conversation. Depending on the state, the bill will pass or the bill won't pass. Basically, all of the bills are unconstitutional and will end up getting enjoined by judges, despite the fact that a third of federal judges are Trump appointed and many have anti-LGBTQ records. The bills generally violate the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. The concrete effect isn't generally changing policies on a more than like one-off basis, and we never know how these get implemented. What it does, it encourages school administrators, athletic associations and stuff like that to try discriminating. And all the conversation about trans bodies, about trans people, framing trans women as predatory, as dangerous, really has a concrete negative effect on trans people and trans children, especially in the states in which these bills are introduced and the country more broadly.
So you framed the kind of socio-political stage pretty well, described it, that this topic is very much based in creating 30-second sound bites for conservative politicians, mm-hmm. Playing to a certain base. Can you get into more of the nuts and bolts of some of these this legislation? I'm sure there's some difference, across the states, but probably not much. I'm sure they're all playing from the same script. But one of the thoughts that I've had, or questions that I've had, is there any differentiation based on, you know, age or grade levels? Clearly, I would think that their arguments break down substantially when you're talking about intramural sports at grades, you know, 1 through, say, 7. And then when you get to a physiological age where folks, you know, do start to go through puberty and hormones do start to become a question, and moving into those high school years, is there a differentiation there? And is there a differentiation as we progress into college age and also like state intramural, NCAA, those kinds of venues?
Yeah, that's a really good question, because you'd think those things might be relevant if they were actually concerned with the realities of trans bodies, competitive advantage in athletics, and stuff like that. They're not. Like I said, this is a non-issue. There is no threat to competitive advantage being raised by, you know, trans bodies going through puberty. Or on hormones, or puberty delayed, or anything like that. Like, people's bodies are different and do different things. Generally, the text of the bills is really similar across states, and addresses basically those areas that, you know, a state government will have jurisdiction over. So we're talking about educational programs that receive government funds, which is most of them, especially through loan programs and stuff like that. We aren't really seeing in any sort of like mass detail what the application of any of these policies will look like in the 9 states in which these are passed, in the 7 in which they're passed and haven't been enjoined already. So in terms of like the concrete details of how these play out in policies of individual athletic associations, school districts, stuff like that, that's not really something that's easy to see, because once again, as a non-issue, like the best data we'll get on the effects of this is generally just like individual cases of people who are willing to talk about what's been done to them, trans people. And I think it's also really important to remember, most kids don't play on sports in order to leverage a competitive advantage or anything. Usually it's a school activity,
right?
You know, that all sorts of kids, you know, play in, participate in for a lot of reasons. It builds leadership, teamwork, a bunch of other things that like a lot of people find valuable,
right?
And people just want to participate. 99.9% of kids in athletic participation aren't doing so on any sort of elite level.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So, so what I'm hearing in your answer is none of these bills are articulating any form of measurable standards. It's a blanket black and white approach. So this is kind of a bridge to my second question, if I may. You know, what I've observed now, since I think going back at least to the 1980s, the International Olympic Committee has had, you know, an internationally accepted set of standards for, you know, those amateur sports. And then there's a credible number of sports, just about any sport you can name is represented, you know, in the Olympics. Why is that not a good enough standard to be used? Why is that ever been argued in any of these cases?
Yeah, certainly, because like that's common sense things to raise in defense of trans kids. Like, even the bodies regulating the most elite levels of athletics have ways of including trans people, whether or not they're ideal, whether or not, you know, even they follow the science in a way that really fully includes trans people. Like, they're supposed to be the experts on this, and they're saying there are ways to include trans people in elite athletics. And then furthermore, I do want to kind of raise, going back to your question about particular details in the policies, the sort of things that are suggested for processes in some of these bills, there'd be like a thing where if you suspect that a girl on a team is transgender, she will be forced to undergo some sort of gender verification procedure or a sex verification procedure. This is suggested in some of the bills. You know, so much so that like one of the plaintiffs against that bill is a cisgender girl, so not a trans girl, who is identifying that this policy is discriminating against her because anyone could just point at her, you know, as a cisgender girl.
Understood.
And say,
yeah,
have to what? Check what sex you are, which is just incredibly invasive, not a standard that's applied to cisgender boys. So that's the sort of, when they get into the details, that's the sort of details they get into.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
And, you know, to me, that brings up another issue. What about intersex kids? You know, if they're having to sort of be checked to make sure that they fit into whatever division they're trying to compete in, you know, what are they supposed to do if, say, their genitals don't match up with, you know, the men's or the women's, whichever they're trying to compete in, or their chromosomes don't line up? You know, how's that going to affect those kids as well?
Yeah, on that question, I think it's important to remember that, you know, the proponents of this sort of legislation don't really acknowledge the existence of intersex people. Like, we're still at the level in terms of advocacy for intersex people to prevent babies from getting surgically altered before they can give informed consent in order to, you know, match the expectations doctors have about like what sex characteristics people are supposed to have. Like, that's where we are. We're on actually getting the federal government to collect data on intersex people and the issues that they're experiencing. So when you get to the application of these uninformed anti-trans attacks on intersex people, on androgynous cisgender girls, on loads of groups, they're not things that we have systems to enforce. The actual costs of what medically verifying bodies is not something school districts are prepared to deal with. It's very much kind of one of those things where if you start asking any specific questions about a made-up problem, you're going to find that there's like a lack of specific answers.
Thank you. Could I ask a question?
Of course.
Okay, great. So one of the things I was wondering is what do transgender youth report about how participation in sports affects their overall self-esteem?
That's a great question. We put out a report in January entitled Fair Play, and it's on our website. It's discussing the actual effects on kids, both cisgender and transgender, of inclusive and exclusive athletics participation policies. And what we found is that inclusive policies materially benefit the mental health of transgender kids. And if we're talking about the mental health of transgender kids, it's important to keep in mind that 2021 data from, was it Trevor Project? 2021 data from the Trevor Project found that more than half of transgender and non-binary youth seriously considered suicide in the prior year. This is the population we're talking about. And if we're talking about exclusive policies increasing suicide risks, which is what we found in our research. If we talk about inclusive policies, if we talk about, you know, school environments where kids aren't misgendered, aren't deadnamed, you know, referred to by a name they were given but is not theirs, that materially decreases these like really serious mental health risks. We looked at states that have had like statewide inclusive policies for transgender participation of athletics and found that the participation of girls in athletics did not go down, was not harmed at all. Cisgender girls actually were participating in athletics like at increased rates compared to the sort of states that were proposing exclusionary policies. And honestly, that makes sense. The sort of places that are interested in including trans people are the sort of places that are actually interested in gender equity in sports. And what that means, what female athletes have been saying for a very long time, is equity in scholarship money, equity in training funding, in equipment, and all of these. Like, if you ask female athletes like what the big concerns are, it's the fact that their teams are just not taken as seriously and their programs are not funded as well, and that sort of thing. So like when you see that trans participation is not hurting cisgender girls, it really just underscores that like what girls in sports actually need is what they're saying they need. Which is support, institutional support, at equitable levels to boys in sports.
Thank you. Dee, how did you become involved in advocating for trans athletes?
What's my personal history of getting involved in advocating for trans athletes? Honestly, I don't want to have to talk about trans people in sports. I want to talk about a lot of other things that affect trans people. You know, as a trans woman of color who's had some hairy interactions with medical systems, educational systems, other things, like I am very much focused on how trans youth are treated in school discipline, juvenile justice, the criminalization of survival economies, of homelessness. Like, there are so many issues affecting trans youth right now. And the fact that we have to play defense because a bunch of religious fundamentalists are trying to kill our kids is really kind of distressing to deal with sometimes. I mean, we could be focusing, if we focus on youth, on improving sex education so people aren't at risk of infectious diseases, reproductive health problems. We could be working on the fact that ICE is detaining trans people and children in conditions that amount to torture. Like, we could be focusing on the futures of our children in a situation where there's a climate crisis that neither American political party seems to take remotely seriously. We could be dealing with the fact that our schools are underfunded and teach us about MLK, but not the fact that our government killed him. Like, we can focus on that fact that trans kids are going to grow up to be trans adults facing homelessness, employment discrimination, loads of other issues. Healthcare access is awful, and the best healthcare access that I've run into personally and policy-wise has always been stuff that trans people have put together for themselves. I am involved in fighting for the rights and lives of LGBTQ people as my job for a lot of reasons. It's really denigrating not only to all of the trans people affected by these discriminatory policies, but all of the people who want to make life better for trans people, that this has to be our fight.
Do you want to talk more about what exactly the CAP is doing right now to combat this anti-trans legislation and, I guess, any other trans-related issues that are going on right now?
Yeah, sure. You know, our team is part of a large coalition of policy organizations, advocacy organizations, healthcare organizations that are trying to really elevate the needs of LGBTQ people and make sure they're reflected in policy. In terms of the defense we have to play on this particular issue, what we do is mostly coordinating and research support. We'll put out reports like the one I cited from earlier this year, and make sure that the advocates on the local level, on the state level, who are really fighting these bills, you know, the plaintiffs, the trans kids who have to testify and sue in front of federal judges, like, have the information they need to make their arguments effectively and stuff like that. And, you know, so that's what we're doing on this issue. We've got a lot of focuses. This is one that we're playing a more supportive role on.
Thank you. Fee, what does the future of transgender participation in sports look like to you?
The future of transgender participation in sports? I mean, I'm not sure. When I think of gender equity in sports more generally, I want to see a world where women, cisgender, and transgender, especially women of color, like all the Black women that got absolutely denigrated by the Olympic process this year. I want to see a world where they're celebrated for the incredible work and effort that they do. I want to see a world where people see trans bodies and don't immediately think of a threat, don't immediately think of someone trying to infiltrate something or like harm anybody, but just somebody living in a body that they're trying to figure out how to live in like the rest of us. I don't know. I don't really play sports myself. Like, So I'd want to leave the future of transgender participation in sports up to the transgender people that do it. But, you know, I like to imagine a world where sports and many other spaces can actually celebrate the people who have been excluded from them and those people's bodies.
Do you think that the legislative effort that's going on right now is eventually going to die out, and maybe this issue will settle down into something more manageable for trans and queer folks?
I think if we look at the history of Christian fundamentalist attacks on LGBTQ people and our rights, we'll find that this issue may die down, maybe in the next few years. I mean, they came hard for gay marriage, lost it in the courts eventually, then were trying to figure out what to do next. Trump got into power, the whole agenda probably got confused on their end, and they have, after trying to ban trans people from using restrooms in North Carolina back in, was it 2018, they kind of tested things out in their playbook, and in Idaho last year, found that sports was a good messaging thing. I don't know what public attention and opinion about trans people in sports is going to look like moving forward. I imagine people will stop paying attention at some point. They will move on to a different angle. It will be an attack on transgender people. And we're going to have to play defense then too.
Yeah.
Are you aware of any of the cases that have made it into court that have progressed? You know, what's the highest level that any one of these cases has progressed to? How far away from a Supreme Court case do you think we are?
Since state laws are at question, since the state is being sued, these things are handled in federal courts. So there are federal judges on circuits who make these decisions initially. If the decision is appealed, it can go to an appellate court, which is also a federal court, just at a higher level. If the decision there is appealed, it can go to a Supreme Court.
But you have mentioned, Thea, that at least two of these were rejoined, and that almost all of the legislation that's been introduced has been in violation of
actually the 14th Amendment of the Constitution, which guarantees that, you know, all people will be equally protected under the laws of our government. And basically, the constitutional issue with these bills is that they specifically are applied to trans girls or targeted at trans girls in a way that does not apply to girls who are similarly situated. So if you look at the effect this bill has on a trans girl compared to the effect it has on a cis girl, you see that the law is just very unequally applied, and that is a constitutional violation.
So it sounds like they're all going to get overturned, basically, at some point.
I don't want to make any promises. Whether a thing is constitutional or not is something ultimately a judge will decide. Whether or not it is constitutional, that is a decision that is made by a person. And 1/3 of federal judges were appointed by Donald Trump.
Isn't it crazy that we're talking about this instead of talking about all the ways that we can be supporting trans kids and trans people of color, like we end up having to spend so much time, like you were saying, playing defense, talking about non-issues, when there's all of these other issues, that beautiful list that you mentioned earlier in the interview of things that we really could be doing to support trans kids.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, conversion therapy still exists. That's where they take a kid and verbally abuse them until they no longer try to be themselves in front of their parents and their community. That still exists. That's traumatizing. And plenty of states have not banned this and consider it, you know, like, plenty of states still have systems like that in effect. States are, in addition to banning kids from sports, trying to ban any sort of gender-affirming care for minors. You know, you talk about medically necessary care. You talk about how the American Association of Pediatricians, the American Medical Association, national and international bodies, medical professionals have repeatedly said that the sort of care that's administered and given to kids is appropriate and necessary. And the fact that it's being called mutilation, child abuse by Christian fundamentalists, and then denied to kids, once again, part of a population, almost half of whom have considered suicide in the past year, often for reasons involving gender dysphoria. They're very much trying to kill us, you know.
Yeah, and see, the funny thing is, the ironic thing, I guess I should say, not so much funny, is, you know, these fundamentalist Christians, they, and conservatives in general, they argue that, you know, trans women shouldn't be allowed to compete in women's sports, trans girls shouldn't be allowed to compete in girls' sports because of, you know, hormones once they go through puberty. They think that that'll give them some sort of a physical advantage, which it doesn't, but that aside, well, if you're so worried about that, then shouldn't that be more of a case to allow kids to take puberty blockers? Which, you know, and like you said, they claim that that's child abuse, but I'm like, no, what's really child abuse is forcing a child to go through a puberty that they don't want, that is dysphoric and physically painful for them, and that they may never be able to fully reverse.
Yeah, that's a really important point. And I think it's important to remember, again, that people leading these attacks aren't concerned with competitive advantage in sports and stuff like that. I don't know. Is there a competitive advantage in gender segregated prisons? And if not, why are they trying to get trans women into men's prisons where they're at higher risk of being put in solitary, being sexually abused, being physically abused, both by guards and other inmates? Like, trans people in gender segregated spaces is not about any sort of neutral judgment or reason. They are really clamping down on trying to make life worse for trans people through policies like this.
Thea, have you heard anecdotally any information regarding how people who identify as non-binary are treated in gender segregated sports and gender segregated activities within the school system?
I think it can depend a lot. I think, first of all, there are a hell of a lot of people who are non-binary. I don't know if that's FCC okay.
That's sorry. Fine.
There are a ton of people who are non-binary, and a lot of them have different experiences with gender segregation, with how they feel about gender segregation and how gender segregation is imposed on them. We got non-binary athletes winning Olympic medals, which is bloody fantastic. I love that. I love to see it. And we've also got probably plenty of kids who don't know where they fit in. I'd encourage y'all to look for their stories and see what they have to say.
Yes, in terms of your organization's prioritizing resources, where does this issue fit? And you know, I assume because you are part of a coalition of other advocacy groups and legal defense groups, that your priorities, you know, may not be universal across the board, but where does this topic fit in terms of how your organization is using its resources at this point?
What I can say on the record is that in the media right now, you know, as someone who does track media coverage of LGBTQ policy issues, discussion of trans participation in sports is by far the loudest topic. And, you know, it's framed as a culture war thing. It's very much covered with the same narratives and messaging that they covered fights around marriage equality and other issues. And there are lots of people with opinions that don't reflect the realities of policy or science. Which means that all this loud stuff means that even on a team where this is not our major focus, this has to be something on our plate that we're dealing with, that we're doing research and reports on.
Then if I have one other kind of legal-based question, based on, you know, your knowledge, to your knowledge, do you have a perspective on how the United States Department of Justice is or is not actively engaging in any of these cases?
Just give me a second. Okay, yeah. I was just double checking something.
Sure, thanks.
So the DOJ, the Department of Justice, is not stepping into these cases on a way that steps on the toes of the advocates who are representing the kids affected. What they're doing is clarifying that is the department's position that these restrictions are unconstitutional, you know, as the judges ruled, making sure it's clear from, you know, the Biden administration, from the department, what the legal interpretation that makes sense to them is.
Okay, thank you. Because as I know, the previous administration, the Department of Justice was at least beginning to posture and send some indications that they would participate together with states on some of these issues, not just trans participation in sports. Anyway, yeah, so for now, at least.
Yeah, if you want to talk about how DOJ was moving under the Trump administration, I feel like that's like two more hours.
No, I don't want to talk about that.
It's a bit traumatic, isn't it?
So I guess the takeaway, it looks like we're getting near the end of the show. I just kind of want to wrap up some really important points I feel like you brought up in this interview. Some of them were really early. I feel like one of the most important things that you had to share with us was the idea that, like, this is really a non-issue. And for almost all sports that kids participate in school, they're not like elite level sports where this is even an issue. I mean, they're most sporting, I mean, maybe people don't understand this, but most sporting activity is designed for the health and the benefit of the kids. And it's there so that they can have physical activities, so that they can learn all kinds of great social and skill building relationships that come from participating in sports, and helps to build their self-esteem. And it gets them physical exercise. That's like the whole point of it, is to get physical exercise. And so it's not really about your gender. It's just about this, you have a body and, you know, you get your body out and you get it active. That's kind of what I was hearing.
Yeah. No, I think, yeah, it's really important to remember what things are actually happening and why people are doing them. You know, the folks who are advocating for these bans, you know, what they're saying is different from what they believe. And when you look at the bare reality of the situation, of what kids were talking about, of what the kids' motivations are, of what the kids' experiences in school, on and off the fields are, like, you realize that not only is this like often a non-issue, it's one of the smallest issues that kids are facing. I mean, kids deal with a lot of things, you know, trans teens especially. Like, there's a lot of shit that happens that these kids are dealing with. And the fact that these lawyers are trying to make it a government priority to create more issues for these kids is not only cruel, it's an absolute abuse of what our government can and should do.
Thank you. Yeah, let's encourage kids to just get involved in whatever gives them joy. You know, I mean, it's about celebrating bodies and having bodies and celebrating, you know, being able to do whatever your body is able to do in whatever way you choose to do it. So let's celebrate that for our kids and, you know, really open up the space so the kids can, you know, explore all the ways in which their bodies can be.
Yeah, I would love that.
We've been talking tonight with
Thea Santos.
Thea Santos, thank you, from the Center for American Progress. Thea, it's really been a pleasure. If people want to find out more about the Center for American Progress and all of the good work that you all do advocating for justice issues, where can they find out about that?
Our organization's website is AmericanProgress.org. There you can find a range of policy issues that different teams at the organization do some work on. And you can find the research that we've done.
Great. Well, it's really been a pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much for joining us tonight on Transpositive.
Yes, thank you, and thank you for the work that you're doing. Thank you.
Thank you all.
So Jean, Nicolette, thanks so much for joining us at the end of the show to sort of do a wrap up of today's show on trans youth and sports. So Nicolette, what do you think about what was talking about today?
So, I mean, basically the reason that we're talking about the trans youth and sports issue is because for many years, trans kids have been able to compete in sports on usually, you know, on the teams of the gender that they identified with. And it wasn't an issue. You know, it was for validation, it was for safety, and it was working for a long time, and it's because of this sudden uprise in transphobia lately that several states started introducing bills that would force children to play on the play in the division of their assigned sex, their quote unquote biological sex, which I don't even know how they would be checking for that. That sounds like an invasion of privacy. And it also brings up the issue, well, then what about intersex kids? They aren't going to fit into either of these binary categories anyway, you know? So there's all sorts of issues that this raises, and it's just straight up not safe for these kids to be forced into a division that, you know, doesn't work for them, either in terms of validation or just it makes them feel unsafe. You know, I can imagine that, say, a trans girl would not feel safe dressing in a boy's locker room, for example. So it sounds like they're putting these kids in danger and also just trying to take away from them something that they enjoy.
I have a number of observations. And first of all, while I don't disagree with, you know, your basic premise, Nicolette, I make these observations. First of all, there are some clear lines of demarcation. And when we talk about youth, there's, you know, intramural sports in elementary school that don't involve a locker room, don't involve anything like that, any kind of changing and exposure. Then you get into middle school, and, you know, maybe in some middle schools, you may have some, you know, shower and locker room things, but the same interests that are pushing these bills in the various states are the same ones that have axed the public school funding such that middle schools probably don't have very, very few and far between situations where they engage in, you know, locker rooms and showers. It's not until you get into high school where you have those kinds of exposures. And then to follow on to that, I make this observation. It's not until you get into high school that you arguably have hormonal differences, pubertal differences that seem to be the basis for a lot of the legislations and proposals and arguments that we are hearing. Really, what is going on here is, though there are arguably, theoretically, situations, there, what, half of a percent, you know, half of a percent? This is just not a big issue. And so what's really going on here is this issue is being used as a political lightning rod. It's being used as a get out the vote motivational piece. We've been used as political footballs now for quite a while, and now the kids are seriously being used. And it's basically, what I'm saying here is, it's a non-issue. It's a non-issue. It's being made an issue by interests that I will agree with you, Nicolette, are transphobic, but it really doesn't have boodly squat to do with reality. There's my download.
Yeah, it really is a non-issue. I mean, even the supposed concerns being raised that, you know, AMAB people have some sort of biological advantage over AFAB people. We've had multiple studies now confirming that that's not really the case. And even if people were concerned about that, that should be more of a case to allow trans youth to take puberty blockers, you know, if you're really that worried about it. And yet the same people will complain about that too.
Yes, I agree, Nicolette. What's interesting and fascinating to me about this whole, I'm not even gonna call it a debate, it's a media episode, is that the arguments are both founded in exactly the same, you know, basic biological knowledge base. It's the conclusions that are where people, you know, are at odds.
I think what this really does is this offers us, this is really a moment, a really key moment, I think, in the whole, like, in our struggle for rights. And it's because, like, right now there's enough transgender kids, like, who are in school, and that the culture is at a point where it's having to accommodate and adjust to the reality of our existence in spaces where before there was this thought that somehow we didn't really exist there. And I think that this is really this is kind of a breakthrough moment for us. And I think the fact that there was so much legislation, like trying to keep trans kids from participating in sports, just shows like how much participation there probably already is. And so I think that, like, if you kind of take it and flip it over and look at it from the other side, you can kind of like if you look underneath the motivation that's like driving all this and look at like what's pushing it from our end, it's that we're really like, I mean they're afraid. And that's like part of what we've said all these years. I mean, they're afraid because they don't know how to deal with us and what we are. And that's just because they are locked in this, you know, this idea about what people are that's not real. And we're in every space in society because we've always been here. And we're just, you know, saying there's trans kids, they go to school, they want to participate in sports. And not only does this force you to rethink what you think gender is and what heteronormativity is, but this also might get you having a conversation about what sports is too. And that's a conversation that's desperately needed, because, you know, we don't need binary sports. I mean, there's some places where maybe we need binary sports, but there's also, we need other options too. We need to acknowledge that there's all different kinds of bodies. And in the same way that we like celebrate, you know, different kinds of bodies in within our movement, like, we need to celebrate the fact that there's all different kinds of kids' bodies too, and figure out, like, well, what is the purpose of sports? You know, the purpose of sports should be for kids to get some exercise, to have some fun, to do some bonding. You know, it's like sports is not about intense competition, like who's going to win, who's, you know, that. I mean, I understand that that's always going to be part of sports, but that's not like, that should not be at the very top of our mind when it comes to our kids in grade school and junior high and high school. I mean, this is a time where sports should be about just, you know, being involved and doing things, being physical. And maybe we can help with that conversation too, in addition to like helping people who are attached to heteronormativity see that we exist and we've always been here. Well, thanks so much, everyone. Thanks for joining us on Transpositive. And Jean and Nicolette, thanks for stepping in to help close out the show. Bedroom surprise.